Welcome to the Pesky Report, a podcast for Red Sox fans.
Hello, hello, everyone. Live from the city of Watertown, Massachusetts, wherever Hogdale is in Iowa. I'm actually not sure. We're in Iowa exactly, are you?
I'm in Clinton.
Clinton, Iowa, and Portland, Maine, with Emma Tiedman, our guest today. Did I get that right?
Yes.
So Emma is the play-by-play, does play-by-play for the Portland Sea Dogs, the AA affiliate for the Boston Red Sox, but I know that your role extends to a little bit more than that. So could you just tell us a little bit about what you do for the Sea Dogs?
Yeah, so I mean, my primary role is play-by-play broadcaster. I call every single game, whether it's at home at Hadlock Field or on the road. So I'm on the bus with the guys and on all of those trips, and then beyond that, I help with all the media relations. I assist some with the social media, you know, talking with reporters and you know, coordinating interviews for any guys that want to talk to our players. I do the game notes every day, the stat packs, the rosters, kind of communicate with the clubhouses to make sure they have everything they need. And then I do all the roster moves, communicating with the Red Sox, with minor league and major league baseball, and then again with both clubhouses and then both sets of broadcasters, and distributing all of those new rosters and numbers and collecting all that information as it comes in. And then, you know, cart pulls and everything else, all the other duties as assigned. It's a, you know, busy but a really, really fun job to do.
Yeah. Now, how did you get started on this? How I know that your grandfather was in the same industry. Would you say that had to do with how you ended up moving into the field?
Oh, for sure. I wouldn't be here without him. You know, I grew up, you know, playing every sport under the sun. I grew up in Dallas, Texas. So during recess in elementary school, I was playing football with the boys. I hit my growth spurt very early in life. So I was a pretty good, you know, person to throw into the end zone because I could reach over all the boys, even though they never threw me the ball. But I saw the strategy in that. But, you know, I played every sport I could. I just loved being active, and I loved, you know, the different kind of strategies, whether you're playing basketball or softball or what have you. And, you know, at that point in my life, I wanted to be a veterinarian. I loved animals. But once I got into high school, I realized that I was really bad at science and math, which are two key subjects for veterinary school. And so luckily around that time, my sophomore year of high school, my grandfather was getting ready to call a Division III men's basketball game or women's basketball game. And he had an extra headset because his student wasn't able to make the game, and he gave it to me and said, you know, you know basketball, why don't you, you know, try this out? And I loved it. I loved having just to be on the entire time, and you never knew what was going to happen in front of you. So from that moment, I was hooked on play-by-play, and I really haven't ever looked back.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's certainly a big difference from that in veterinary school. Do you have any pets or anything like that now?
Oh yeah, I have a 20-year-old cat. He's gonna be with us for probably another 20 to 30 years at this rate. And then I have a dog I adopted in college. And I still can like name every dog breed and stuff. Like I still, you know, have that connection, but now it's just play by play at nights and yeah, you know, not going to work at a veterinary office.
Yeah, wow, 20 years. That's I feel like any pet owner, that's probably not enough, but 20 years feels like a pretty good run. What kind of dog?
He's a collie shepherd mix.
Oh my god.
So he's a big guy. But
this is mine right here.
Oh.
This is Penny. So you went to school in Missouri, right?
Yes.
What did you study there?
So I started in the journalism school. I thought it was amazing that, you know, day one, you could be working for whether it was an NBC affiliate, an NPR affiliate for the radio station. You know, they have the Missouri method. So the Missouri method is you go out and do the work. You don't just talk about it in the classroom. You go and experience it. So my first week I was out covering high school football for the NBC affiliate. And then I was doing play-by-play for volleyball for, at the time it was Big 12. And I thought it was the coolest thing. And I was doing that while also being in the J school. And whenever it came to the end of my sophomore year, they put you onto your track. And so for the different tracks, it was producing or anchoring, reporting. And then, you know, they have the news side and the sports side, and they didn't have play-by-play. And I, at that point, I had been working in the TV side of things and the radio side of things. And I really didn't like anchoring. I really didn't like reporting. I just loved play-by-play. And so to give me a little bit more time to do that, I decided to actually major in education because I also knew that, you know, play-by-play is, you know, way to make a little money if needed, because you also don't make a lot of money in this industry. So I actually majored in secondary social studies education with a minor in history and then a multicultural certificate. So a little bit of everything, but the whole time I was doing play-by-play on the side.
That's really interesting. And I mean, definitely smart to have that ace in the hole just in case, because as you said, you know, it's a tough in anything in entertainment, I feel like sports, that sort of thing. It's just really hard. It's a struggle no matter how you're doing it. And it's actually, I was looking at your career path, and it looked like you went, you had some pretty interesting teams that you were kind of following. The one that stands out to me the most was the Alaska League. How the heck did you end up there?
Yeah, so Alaska really changed my whole career path. At that point in college, I was going into my senior year. And at that point, I was thinking, okay, I would like to work for a network and do, you know, play-by-play all year, variety of sports. That seems really fun to me. And so when I looked at kind of all the sports that I had done play-by-play with, baseball was my weakest. I just didn't have as much, you know, reps under my belt. I didn't know the sport as much because I played volleyball and basketball religiously growing up. And so I figured, hey, if I could, you know, call a whole bunch of games in a very short amount of time, I should get better. So I Googled, you know, summer collegiate teams in the United States. At the time, there was a massive Wikipedia page and it listed out every single league. So of course the Cape was on there, the Coastal Plains League, Northwoods, I mean, all of those that we always hear about. And so I went to each league's website. I went to each team's website and I sent an email to every GM saying, you know, if you have a broadcast position open, I would like to apply for it. Here's my resume. Here's my tape. And only two people really responded. And one of them was in Alaska. And I had a couple interviews with him and with the GM, and his wife was awesome. And, you know, I just love their kind of philosophy of, you know, they're bringing all these people from the lower 48 up to Alaska. And, you know, they just kind of want to show off the state. And you know, they have cookouts and all this stuff at their house. And it's a really family environment. And so I said, why not? They said they would pay for my airline ticket and give me a car and a host family. I never got paid. But I was like, well, when am I ever going to go to Alaska? So I boarded a flight from Dallas to Anchorage. I had a oh crap moment as we were landing into Anchorage because it was 11 o'clock at night, still bright as day outside because the sun never sets in the summer. And we flew in over like the biggest mountains I've ever seen in my life. And I have a window seat. And I'm like, oh my God, what have I done? Like, this is terrifying. And it turned out to be the best experience of my life. I fell in love with the sport of baseball, the game of baseball. I had talks with our manager every single game about just little things that, cause he would listen to the broadcast the same night. And so he would kind of critique and also tell me like, okay, well, this is why we did this. And this is why we bunted here. Those little things that, you know, he was just so helpful about. And then I also fell in love with, you know, the grind of going to a game every single day, or getting on a bus and going to Fairbanks or to go into the Kenai Peninsula, you know, all that stuff. I just was hooked. And so I've been in baseball ever since.
That's such an interesting place to start also, because I mean, for me, that sounds like a dream. So like where the sun never sets, that sounds absolutely amazing. I mean, are they doing like 11 PM games there because of that? Or is it kind of still the normal, like 7 o'clock start time?
Yeah, so they do one midnight sun game a year. Unfortunately, our team wasn't chosen for it my season, but you know, it's typically up in like Fairbanks when it's even further north. And yeah, they don't even use the stadium lights. Like, and it starts at about 11 o'clock at night. It's crazy. And like 4th of July, we didn't have fireworks because what's the point?
You can't see them.
Exactly. Yeah.
How old were you when you were doing this? Like, were you 21 yet?
Yes, I was 21. Yep.
So that's like kind of, I imagine that as being kind of like one of these, almost like a coming of age story type movie where it's like, oh, I'm coming into Alaska to do broadcast for a year and this is what happened this summer. And it's like you have, you know, like you in your 40s doing the Wonder Year style narration over it. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, it really would be. I mean, even looking back now and it's in the whole grand scheme of life, it's not too far removed from where I am right now. And like, even then I'm like, man, I was just a kid. And it was really the perfect time, you know, in my life to be able to be 21 and go out to the one bar that was in town and grab drinks and, you know, and then also kind of learn to get into a routine with baseball, much like the players, like broadcasters have a similar kind of routine too. So it was a kind of trial by fire. And my play-by-play luckily got better. It was god awful. And so it was so bad. My mom was like, I don't know if she can do this. Like, this is not good. But credit to my grandfather. He was living in North Carolina the entire time. And, you know, that's like a 4 or 5 hour time difference because Alaska has a different time zone. He would stay up, listen and watch every single game and critique me. And so I got better by the end of the season, thank goodness. And, you know, it kind of has helped get me to where I am today.
Would you say like get better? Like what would you say were like the big changes that you made? I mean, I figure that experience probably helps just doing it more, but were there any specific changes to your style that you really became clear to you when you were doing it every day?
Oh, tons. I think the big one in Alaska, I think it was really just getting used to like calling the positions correctly. And it sounds like I was an idiot and I didn't know first base and second base, but like the little nuances, like you don't play catcher, you are catching tonight. Those little things, removing words from my vocabulary, the word get, that's my grandfather's biggest thing. You can use any verb to describe more accurately what is going on besides the word get. Like if you have a fly ball to the outfield, like, okay, fly ball to left field, left fielder comes in and, you know, gets it for the final out. Well, you could say that he, you know, jogs in to make the catch. He, you know, hustles in or you know, any little things like that. I was more aware of the vocabulary that I was using. And then slowing down the big plays, you know, especially if there were runners on base and, you know, you have runners at second and third and then you have a drive to the gap, you know, focusing on the ball and what the outfield is doing, but also having to come back and tell the listeners, okay, well, one run has come. You go back to the ball and say, well, the second runner is now at third or he's rounding third. What's the outfielder doing? Okay, he's throwing it in now. So it's those little things of not letting the big moments kind of get swept up, and also just knowing that if I do mess it up, I can always go back and recap what actually happened.
Yeah, no, that seems like definitely a trial by fire kind of thing. Now, how big is the audience for the Matsu Miners, which I didn't mention before? That was the team, the Matsu. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, Matsu Miners. Yep. yeah, they're based in the Matanuska Valley, just outside of Anchorage. I never really knew the audience level, like the total. It was just a lot of families watching on YouTube because that's where we would stream the videos. And then, you know, whenever we would hit the road, it was a lot of the host families would watch too. And our GM and his wife also. So I don't know, maybe 50 people on a good night. Maybe I could probably go back and look if I really tried, but it wasn't a massive audience.
Now this is, I've never been to Alaska before. So this is more my own curiosity, but what teams do they generally follow there?
I mean, the Alaska Baseball League had, I think they had six in the league. And, you know, at that time they were probably the second best summer collegiate league in the country behind the Cape. So like we had a whole bunch of guys that got drafted. Nick Senzel, who's with the Reds right now, he was part of my team. So yeah, the colleges that they came from were like, Tennessee was a big one. And then a lot of colleges in California.
Oh, wow. Senzel, wasn't he a second? He was taken second in the draft or third in the draft or something like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a big name. Why? No, again, I don't know a ton about the collegiate leagues, but why? What would make a player pick Alaska over the Cape or like a different collegiate league? Like what? Is it just a numbers game or like what sends somebody up there?
So honestly, I think it has to do a lot with the coaches too. I kind of dealt more with like the player side whenever I was with my second summer collegiate league in Oregon. So. A lot of the times the coaches will just tell the players like, hey, this team reached out. They would like you to come play for them. This is where you're going. A lot of the time it's just the relationships that the coaches have, like their university or college coaches have with the summer collegiate team and organization. And then the Cape, I don't know how the Cape does it because they pull all of the top prospects and typically the top draft guys. But yeah, it was typically, you know, the coaches would reach out. We'd try and, you know, grab some of the local guys, maybe, you know, talk to somebody who we knew was probably coming home for the season coming home for the summer and talk to their summer coach, get the green light and talk to them and kind of sign them. So it's just kind of like it's both the college coach, the summer collegiate organization and the player just all kind of working together to try and figure something out.
Now, before we move on to some of the other teams that you've played with, I'm just you mentioned the manager, and who was the manager, and what was the most what did you learn most about baseball from him?
Ooh, so our manager was Taylor, and he was a catcher, and one day I tried to ask him about like the pitches because I tried, and I'm still trying to work on that. The pitch recognition from up in the booth can sometimes be a little bit difficult. And so it's like, well, how do I, you know, and we also didn't have really radar guns from what I can remember in Alaska. So it was hard to tell like, oh, a slider or a slurve or a curve, what the heck was that? And so I asked him, I was like, how do I have the pitch? Like, how can I get better at that? He's like, I was a catcher. I didn't know what was coming at me. I don't know. I was like, I don't know if that's helpful or honest, but he was just that kind of guy. Yeah. Ben Taylor was great. But it was just honestly his patience with me and made me feel comfortable to, you know, ask any question that I wanted to. And, you know, and I still ask questions today. You can ask our manager and hitting coach and pitching coach. I still bug them. So.
Yeah, no, but I'm sure they appreciate that. And it definitely shows in your play-by-play, I can say, from listening to, you know, just listening to enough Sea Dogs games, because for me, I try to follow as much minor league games as I can. And, you know, with the MILB, you end up getting a lot of like other affiliates. And sometimes, you know, sometimes I think that people definitely, it's a high knowledge, but not everybody seems like has a really in-depth knowledge of the game and how that works. And I can see, I mean, I can definitely see just asking as many questions to be able to figure that out. Now, some of the other teams you have worked for before heading to Portland, the Medford Rogues, the St. Paul Saints, and the Lexington Legends. Now, is that pretty common to kind of bounce from team to team like that when you're getting started?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, and for me, I bounced around a little bit because it was a little bit more difficult for me to break into minor league baseball and into affiliate. So, you know, Medford was one that I knew I could kind of grow in and work full time. And work a variety of roles in the front office. So I actually kind of mirrored that to what I would have to do at a minor league team. And so I picked up the media relations, the social media. And then, you know, St. Paul was awesome because I didn't get hired by an affiliate that year. But the Saints are such an incredible organization and they do really, it's really St. Paul and Portland on the game day presentation and the way that they handle their fans. It was awesome. And then, you know, finally broke into minor league baseball with Lexington. And so, yeah, I mean, some people get lucky and they get to land in a spot that they're there for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But, you know, I was open to moving. And I think that moving around and seeing not only different parts of the country, but also different levels. I got to see summer collegiate for 3 years. I got to see independent, single A, now double A. I think it's just been a really cool experience.
What do you do during the off season?
All sorts of stuff. In Portland, I am full time. So I work a 9 to 5 here at the ballpark. I hate going home at 5 o'clock. That the week after the season ends is like the worst week ever because you go home at 5 and you're like, well, dang, I would have liked to call a baseball game tonight. So I really hate the off season, but it's fun here in Portland. You know, we start planning immediately. We're actually already planning for next year for the promotions. I, you know, knock out the media guy, which takes quite a while. You know, I already have plans to destroy and rebuild up my game notes for next year. And then aside from the 9 to 5 with Portland, I do some freelancing around here at the University of New England. So some basketball, plan on doing some football this fall too. So, you know, just trying to stay busy.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I mean, you've got to have some name recognition in the area now. I'm sure that that makes, I'm sure that that helps a lot when it comes to the freelancing.
Oh yeah, for sure. It was really cool because people reached out to me while the season was wrapping up asking if I wanted to call games and stuff. And I was like, wow, okay. Yeah, sure. I'll do anything. That sounds awesome. So yeah, it's really cool to, you know, make the off season go by a little bit quicker.
Now, coming from Texas and living in all of these other spots, I mean, Portland's definitely a little bit different. How has adjusting to that area been for you?
It's been great. I mean, I came in 2020 and in a time that was difficult. But, you know, I think it showed the just fantastic organization that the Sea Dogs are, because on my first day, we were all sent home to work from home. And, you know, I had a lot of friends in this industry that were furloughed pretty quickly, you know, and there were other broadcasters and stuff. And I was pretty nervous that I was going to get furloughed too. And, you know, say, hey, well, sorry you came up here, but we have to go back to Kentucky. But the Sea Dogs, you know, president and owners, you know, decided that they were going to keep us on all full time. And even paid our game day workers as well, because, you know, that was income that we were all expecting. So, you know, I was very happy to be in a part of an organization that did that, because it was, I mean, it was phenomenal to take care of their employees like that. And then, you know, slowly I got to know the city of Portland as everything started to open up, because Maine closed down pretty quickly. It was closed for a while, but I think it made me appreciate the state a little bit more. I got to see the old port empty and go into all the shops that are typically, you know, full of tourists, and got to talk to a lot of the locals because there weren't any tourists around. So I love Portland. I cannot say it enough of how much I love the city. I love Maine. I've even come to enjoy the winter because I learned how to snowboard last year. So, you know, it's such a fun place. I mean, who can say you go to the beach during the season or during the summer, and then the off season you get to go and snowboard and ski and stuff. So it's pretty cool.
If you were recommending one restaurant for somebody visiting Portland to go to, what's it going to be?
Ooh, that one's tough, because if it's, okay, so I would say Via Vecchia, because I feel like a kindred spirit with that restaurant, because it also opened in April of 2020. And I got to go there like the first month it was open, and now it's booming. Like, you have to have a reservation to get in there, but it's awesome. The food is divine. They change up the menus. They've got the seafood. They've got the cocktails. The restaurant is beautiful right there on the old port across the street from the water. It's awesome.
Yeah, definitely the seafood in this part of the country definitely beats the Midwest, definitely beats Texas.
Yeah.
No offense, Hogdale, there with your Iowa seafood.
There's literally none taken. The seafood here is completely terrible, unless it's like the locally caught like bass or like a walleye. Like, dude, we're importing the shrimp. It's terrible. Like, it's not an insult whatsoever.
No, so let me ask you. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, I first heard you last year because I was listening to a Red Sox game while I was working at Casey's. You were on did a mid-inning interview with Castig, and I believe Sean McDonough was there as well. It was one of the few games he calls. And it's funny because I went back today and I listened to it, like, hearing you talk about, oh, yeah, you know, Josh Winkowski's, you know, having a really solid year for us, and Brian Bayo has looked really good. So, like, how's it, like, feel to see these guys like you called games for, like, come up to the major league level and make an impact?
Oh, it's the coolest feeling ever. And even at that game last year, so that was my first game at Fenway, which I don't know if I can ever go back, because nothing's ever going to be, you know, topping that, going on the radio with Joe Castiglione. I think I've already just reached my peak. But you know, it's so cool to see, because at that game, Carlos Hernandez was pitching for the Kansas City Royals, and he was one of my former players in Lexington. And that was the first time I got to see a former player pitch in person. And it's so funny, because, like, even now I'm looking out, our pitchers are warming up right now in the field, And, you know, we've got a sellout crowd here at Hadlock Field is 7,368 fans, and it's awesome. But then you go see them play at Fenway, and there are tens of thousands of people there. I mean, it's so cool to think, like, you know, at the end of the day, it's just baseball. It's just a baseball field. And here's this one guy that I got to interact with in Portland, Maine, and now he's pitching at the highest level, or he's batting at the highest level. It's just the coolest feeling, because, you know, in minor league baseball, you get to know them a little bit more, I think, and you get to see, you know, the peaks and the valleys and the slumps, and, oh, you know, this guy just walked five batters in his last outing, and, you know, all those things, and you get to see them rise up again and, you know, and then succeed, go up to AAA. And when they reach the majors, it's just the coolest thing, because it's, you know, they've achieved a dream, and that's why we're all doing this.
Yeah. It's really the way that you are articulated. That is so perfect. I love minor league baseball, and I think more so when the major league team is doing badly, but I also think that there's a reason for that, though, that isn't just like, oh, well, I hate seeing losing. It's minor league baseball, I don't think, is as built around winning and losing. It's about player development. It's about having fun. And it's about seeing these people just go after it, go after their dreams, go after their goals. And it's really, it really, to me at least, when a guy goes from AA to AAA or gets that call up from AAA to the majors, it's the most amazing thing. It really is, because it's like you are seeing someone's dream come true in real time. And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it was my dream to be on a major league broadcast. And so I got that at Fenway too, but it's awesome to see, you know, Winkowski, you know, doing so much better, and Bayo before going on the IL, you know, doing a lot better and stuff. And yeah, it's awesome.
So before we go into a little more Sea Dogs chat, I do want to know how you got the job with the Sea Dogs, because I read that you got it over 140, 150 other candidates. And was it like a reality show? Like, who picked the new Sea Dogs play-by-play person? Like, how did that process go where they had such an exact number?
Yeah. So, I mean, and it goes back to what I was talking about earlier, how this is such a competitive industry. Yeah, so it was for every job, basically, there's between 100 and 150 people and applying for it. And especially with the job, like here in Portland with the Sea Dogs, everyone wants this job. So my friend texted me late at night one night, and he said, you know, oh, are you going for Portland? And I said, no one goes for Portland because Portland's never open. And I checked online, and they had posted a job, because obviously Mike Antonellis with a very well-deserved move up to AAA. And so I talked to my boyfriend, but now fiance at the time. And I was like, I don't know, Portland, Maine, like, I don't know if I'm ready for that. And it's a Red Sox affiliate. I don't know if they'll like me. Cause that was half the terror of me broadcasting for the Sea Dogs was Red Sox fans. Because I know how passionate the fan base is, and I didn't want to, you know, upset them. So,
that's a nice way of putting it, passionate.
Yeah, they're brutal. Yeah.
Hey, well, I respect it. You know, I'm a Texas Rangers fan. They don't have the passion. The Red Sox fans have passion. So I applied online, and then a couple days later, the president called me, and we set up an interview. And I had, I think, two or three interviews over the phone, because this was pre-Zoom, because there was no pandemic yet. So everything was over the phone. And at the time, I was still working in Lexington, and calling women's basketball for Morehead State University. So I was on the road, you know, taking these interviews, talking with the trainer with Morehead, being excited about, oh, I think it went well and stuff. And so then they actually flew me up to Portland in February of 2020. And I had one last interview with our president, with our vice president of communications. And then I also talked to Mike. And Mike took me up here to the press box, and he showed me the equipment. And then we had a really frank talk about what this position is with Portland, because, you know, Antonellis and I, our jobs are just so much different sometimes than the rest of the front office. And so we had a really open and honest discussion about, you know, his experiences here and stuff, and which were all great. And it made me want to work here even more. And so then I went back downstairs, and, you know, I was offered the job because they had all talked about me while I was upstairs. And I accepted actually the next day. Yeah, I guess behind the scenes, they sent our tapes out to the entire front office, as well as the resumes for like the top 5 or 10 candidates. The front office staff ranked all the tapes. They sent it to our, obviously our owners as well. And then to season ticket holders, because we have so many and they all listen. So they wanted them to be involved also. So it was not exactly a reality show, but you know, it involved a lot of different people weighing in on who should be the next voice of the Sea Dogs, which I respect. I love the fact that they took so much pride and time into, you know, hiring for this position.
Yeah, but how cool is that also, that out of 150 people, you were the one that got picked? I mean, how do you react when you find that out? And then how do you celebrate?
Yeah, so I reacted by saying, oh, and then probably some cuss words of like, oh my God, it happened.
Awesome.
There were definitely some happy tears, because I wanted to move up so bad, and I really wanted to work for the Sea Dogs, and it was bittersweet too, because I went back to Lexington. I had one more event, and it was actually perfect, because I had all the other female broadcasters in town for an event, and so I got to tell them and kind of celebrate with them. But the night or the day that they offered me the job up in Portland, I was like, no, let me think about it, knowing full well I was going to accept. So I went by myself down to the Old Port, because I was going to explore a little bit. And I went down to the Old Port. I went to the Porthole, which is another fantastic restaurant, by the way. And, you know, in February, there's no tourists around. So it was just me at the bar with a whole bunch of locals. And so I celebrated with lobster mac and cheese, because I had to get something lobster related. Lobster mac and cheese, a beer, and then a shot of tequila. So, and it was just me at the bar.
That's awesome.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Celebratory lobster mac and cheese, I feel like should be a thing for any high A player that gets called up to double A for the Red Sox.
Oh, absolutely.
This
yeah,
so
welcome to Portland. Here's the lobster.
Yes, exactly.
Oh man! So how have the Sea Dogs been this year? How's it been following them 2022 versus 2021?
I'd say it's very different. You know, this season we started off hot with our pitching rotation. I mean, my goodness, they've now all officially moved up to AAA. But it was just a hot start from the beginning with you know, Brandon Walter and of course Brian Baio with the no hitter. It was really pitching heavy, and then the second half of the season, we've seen the offense kind of explode a little bit and put together those timely hits, which is why we're in first place right now in the Northeast Division. And the base running has been off the charts.
Oh, thank God.
David Hamilton single-handedly is just stealing every base he can, it seems like. But then, you know, you have Christian Kost and Sadon Rafaela as well. I mean, it's almost like, well, okay, the Sea Dogs have a base runner on. They're going to steal it. Doesn't matter who it is, they're going to steal another base. It's been so fun.
I'll tell you, it was a lot of fun. The one Sea Dogs game that I went to, it was with my girlfriend's like entire big Irish Catholic family, and it was like 27 people there, and I got to feel so smart, because David Hamilton gets on base at the very beginning of the game, and I go, "Watch this second pitch; he's going to steal second." And he steals second, and it's like, how did you know that? And it's like, because he has like, four, at the time, I think he had 37 steals on the year or something like that.
Yeah.
Because of course he's doing it. Now, how much are you guys in organization now talking about the fact that the record, he's got the record for stolen bases at AA for the Red Sox in his sights? I think it's 66, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's in the 60s. He has the third most in franchise history right now. But yeah, that most in a single season is definitely in his sights.
How hard is that as a broadcaster when you have a guy like that that's just stealing left and right? Like, is it hard to keep track of it with all the runners on base?
Sometimes. But I mean, I like it this year, because I think it adds to, you know, more of like the chess match that's going on. So, you know, now I kind of know, okay, well, Hamilton makes it to first, but doesn't steal second, but the next hitter gets on with a walk or what have you, and Hamilton's at second, somebody else is at first, it's probably going to be a double steal. And so, you know, you can kind of analyze those little things, because the majority of the time that Hamilton has actually been caught stealing is executing a double steal, and he's thrown at third instead of second, which I think a lot of people don't realize, that he's actually almost perfect with stealing second base this season. But I think it's fun. You know, it's really a cool kind of number to keep track of and always talk about. And it's always fun to have a guy on the base pass that can do that kind of damage and really turn the game around single-handedly just being on the base path.
Yeah, no, that's got to be so much fun to watch. Just not even just him. I mean, you've got Rafaela there, who is making web gems at shortstop and center field pretty much on a daily basis. Who would you say is the are a few of the players that fans of just the MLB team should really be looking out for in the next couple of years?
Let's see. Looking at the, I would say Christian Kos. Sorry, I have the cheat sheet of my roster just to my left. Kos has over 100 hits. He's second most in the Eastern League behind Brett Beatty, who's now with AAA. But you know, he has just been so consistent. And you know, the strikeout numbers are still a little bit high, and that was one thing that he was working on this season. But it's the timely hitting for Kos. And you know, he's kind of similar to Pedro Castellanos, who was promoted earlier. Of you know, Castellanos was taking big swings and kind of simplified things a little bit and put it right over the infield and got his batting average up and, it, you know, went on this, it was over 20-game hit streak. I mean, was doing really well. And Kos is, I've kind of noticed the similar thing, kind of just simplifying things a little bit and being a little bit more patient at the plate. So I'd say Christian Kos, he's a great fielder as well, versatile, second base, third base, shortstop. Even in the outfield, we've seen him and David Hamilton a couple of times in center field. And his arm, I don't think, is talked about enough. I mean, he's got a rocket for an arm. So I would say Christian Kos. He's an interesting player, a trade acquisition by the Red Sox. But he's been a really fun guy to watch this year.
Yeah, there were definitely five tools with him. And, you know, these days, five-tool players are pretty tough to come by. The versatility is valuable there. And I mean, some Red Sox fans have probably, I don't know if they remember this or not, but he had that two home run game during spring training this year. And one of those was a walk-off home run. I remember that was one of the first games we got to hear Kevin Youkilis make his broadcast debut. So that's a good name. Question with Castellanos, actually, because he had, I remember his April was one of the, it was he looked like he was on his way out with how things were going in April. And then something in May clicked. And, you know, by the time he got called up, I think his batting average was above 300. Do you know what happened between April and May there?
No, but I know he just kept everything consistent. He didn't change or, you know, worry too much about it. Because, you know, because he was great for us last season. You know, maybe a shortened spring training might have had something to do with that. And kind of everything up in the air, but no, he was great. He just went out, took BP, had a good chat with him at the cage one time because he didn't want to look at video. He didn't want to look at the technology. He just wanted to swing his bat. And that was, you know, in Reading. So he was really picking up steam around there too. And, I think he's definitely an asset at the plate, but you know, he was at first base, up until Tristan Casas was drafted and kind of put in the same level with Castellanos. So he's been playing a little bit more outfield too, but yeah, he's a really solid just overall hitter.
Yeah. Very, very aggressive approach. And I think it's something that I've noticed with a lot of the guys from that are doing well in AAA this year. Like Ronaldo Hernandez also has that very aggressive approach where not a ton of walks, but when he hits the ball, boy, you better watch out.
Yeah. We have Izzy Wilson here. That's pretty similar. He hit one 459 feet the other night.
Oh man, he had one of the best walk-off hits I've seen. I remember he was like a double away from the cycle, and then he hit like his second home run. It was a grand slam, like walk-off grand slam instead of hitting from the cycle. Like, yeah. I feel like you take that trade.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, what is it different a broadcast for you when a player is rehabbing there? Like, I know Kike Hernandez and Tyler Danish are in AA today. I think Michael Wacha was there yesterday. Chris Sale was there earlier in the season. Does that change how you prepare for a game?
A little bit, just because I have more access to information on them. You know, we have our side of the back end of the stats portal, which is great for minor league baseball. It's a lot of information and it's a lot easier to use than when I first started in minor league baseball. They've revamped it. And it's great, but if you're looking at major league players, I mean, you have so much more information to use. You also have Baseball Savant at your fingertips. So I can, with the pitchers, I can, you know, look at the average velocities. You know, Chris Sale, you mentioned, I was able to see, well, his exit velocities have actually decreased for batted balls the last couple of years. And you can go into those little more detailed little data points than you can with some of our guys, which, you know, we have some access to information, we have TrackMan and stuff, but we don't have it laid out like a baseball savant page where I can see, you know, well, Michael Wacha last night, you know, he uses his curveball. I think it was 7% of the time this year at the major league level, but he was using it last night typically for the first pitch of the at-bat for a strike and the last pitch for a strikeout of the at-bat. So, you know, talking about that, well, he's using the curveball more tonight. He only uses it 7% of the time at the big league level and looking at the fastball and the spin rates and all that kind of stuff. So it's really, you just have so much more information at your fingertips to talk about, which I think is awesome. But I also, you know, still want to tell their stories and let, you know, if people know who they are, if maybe they're, you know, because we have the Giants affiliate in town, maybe Giants fans are listening in and they don't really know that much about Chris Sale. They don't know that much about, you know, Kike Hernandez or something. So trying and balancing the numbers and the stories too.
Yeah, there's definitely a human aspect that gets lost in the numbers. And I think that that's true, not just for broadcasting, but, you know, within how sabermetrics are used to build rosters and that sort of thing. Wow. It really definitely sounds like you've come a long way from the, from not knowing like what a curveball looks like versus a slider and all that from your Alaska days.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Do you think you're going to be in Portland for a while, or do you kind of see, do you have like other things that you'd like to explore? Like what are your career goals with that right now?
I mean, right now my goal has been the same the last few years, is to be a major league broadcast voice, radio, preferably, not TV. I would love to stay on radio for the rest of my career. So, you know, I love Portland so much, and I love the Sea Dogs, and I love, you know, the passionate Red Sox fan base, that, you know, I plan on sticking around in Portland for really a long time. Honestly, I love it here. I love coming to work every day, and I love living in Maine. So no plans right now to leave. They're going to have to probably kick me out of the booth eventually. But I'm sticking around.
It's really cool. Yeah. Like someone like you is just a big fan of like just the radio side of broadcasting, especially for baseball, because it really is a special type of artistry. And the way you're able to paint a picture with your voice. I mean, especially like listen to some of the greats like Vin Scully, who we recently lost, like listen to just some of like the tales he could spin. It's just beautiful, like a great artistry. And I'm glad, you know, it keeps getting appreciated.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think that's one thing my grandfather passed along was radio, and you know, how much you can do with it and how you can, you know, be like Vin Scully, and you know, no one will ever match him ever, but you can strive to be like him and strive to use those little things, like use, you know, the crowd to tell the story. And so when my team in Lexington had a walk-off championship for the South Atlantic League, you know, I had some breathing room after, because we still had a crowd there, and we got to celebrate in our home ballpark, which we didn't get to do in the championship the year before. So it's those little things that, you know, you take from the greats and hope, you know, you're a tenth of as good as they are eventually.
Who would you say besides your grandfather or your broadcasting role models?
Eric Nadel with the Texas Rangers. He's been the voice of the Texas Rangers for decades now. He's so great. Him and his partner, Matt Hicks, work so well together. It's just like two friends, you know, watching a baseball game, and the information that they, you know, they relay to the listeners is always so helpful and such a, you know, great way. And then also Mike Capps down in Round Rock, Texas. He's the voice of the Round Rock Express. He's been a family friend for years, and, you know, I can send my tape to him and have a very honest critique back. And so it's, you know, it's those types of people you can send your tapes to, and they're helping you grow, and wanting you to do better and, you know, move up eventually and stuff too. So it's the people like that. Susan Waldman, I know she's with the Yankees, but she's been so fun. You know, I got to meet her at Yankee Stadium a couple years ago, and now we text, and you know, Somerset has players rehabbing, and then we text about, you know, how so-and-so did and stuff. So yeah, she's been phenomenal. She's now going to be in the Radio Hall of Fame. So yeah, definitely Susan Waldman too.
That's really cool. And that's something that I didn't know, that like different, that broadcasters like exchange information like that. What's something else that people might not know about what it's like to work as a minor league broadcaster?
Ooh, good question. Yeah, I mean, all the broadcasters talk. I mean, we talk for a living, so of course we're going to talk to each other. But before every series, the opposing broadcasters and I, you know, we text the starting rotation. That all comes from us. And you know, I think that most people don't realize that, you know, we're typically here at 8 o'clock in the morning for a 6 o'clock game, because we have to put the starting rotations on the websites. We have to do the game notes. We have to put those on the websites. We have to collect the starting lineups. And if we have roster moves, you know, we are the ones that send all that stuff in to minor league baseball. So whenever you kind of see on the player pages that the status has been changed, we sent that email, you know? And so I think a lot of people just think, well, you just show up, you open your scorebook and that's it. But, you know, at the minor league level, we wear so many hats that, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, we're the ones running to the clubhouses. Like yesterday, the Giants made a move 40 minutes before first pitch, and it was me running down to the clubhouses with the new rosters. Then we made a move too, 40 minutes before first pitch. And so I was going back. Yeah. So, and I'm scrambling at my computer trying to insert, you know, Sterling Sharpe's, you know, information and everything like that. So, you know, it's a lot of work that I think that people just like, oh, well, she just showed up an hour ago. Why does she sound tired? I'm like, oh, it's been a day.
I've literally been sprinting back and forth for this.
Yeah.
Has there been a less fence painting this year compared to like last year or the year before that in the pandemic year?
Oh, yeah, definitely less. I noticed actually yesterday somebody was touching up where we painted. So I guess our paint didn't really last, but yeah, we painted all of the handrails and everything, in 2020, as like stadium projects, cause the weather was beautiful and, we needed stuff to do. So, we painted the handrails, we painted some of the kind of structures behind the ballpark too, and cleaned everything up. It was actually fun. It was good team building.
I bet. Yeah.
And it's such a beautiful stadium also. I mean, just getting to work there every day must be pretty wonderful.
Yeah, it's awesome. You know, I think it's small but mighty because we can pack so many people in here. And, you know, whenever it's a close game and it's later innings and GA is filled with people and, you know, they start, you know, putting their feet on the ground and start cheering and stuff. It's really cool. And the booth location, I love it because we're so close. I mean, we have people in front of us sitting, and so it feels like you're in it too with the fans also. Not to mention the monster and the pavilion and all of that, those little odes to Fenway too are really nice touches.
Oh yeah. No, it really is pretty amazing there. Now, this is my last question for the day. I'll let Hogdale finish with his own. But what's been your what's been your favorite game to call this season? What was your absolute favorite?
Oh, this season. Probably Brian Bayo's no-hitter. I mean, because it was a little bit of a wacky game because there were runners on base and errors and stuff. And so, you know, it didn't really feel like a true no-hitter because you're like, well, there's still traffic on the base paths, but but it was awesome. And then being able to, you know, obviously media relations, organizing his interviews post game and stuff. And I mean, him coming out of the clubhouse because he did some phone interviews and holding the phone up for him and stuff. I mean, he was just like a big kid out there smiling because he had never thrown a no hitter. And that was really cool too, because it was a doubleheader. It was the second game of a doubleheader. Brandon Walter absolutely shoved in the first game. We thought that was going to be a no hitter. And so that game ends in really record fashion because it was Walter pitching. So every game finished very quickly. And so we're like, wow, you know, really can't top that. And then here comes Bayo and he tops it with a no hitter. So that was the top of the list. That was great.
What's Bayo like in person? Is he, cause what I've heard about him, when he was like a bit lower in the system, he was like a very emotional kid, like good guy, but just very emotional with his pitching. And something that really helped him was kind of becoming more centered, like, and being able to kind of control his emotions a little bit better.
Yeah. He honestly, he's just like a big kid. He was always laughing and having a good time. And, you know, I think the big change from last year to this year was just the confidence in his stuff. Just knowing that, well, yeah, his fastball can touch 98, 99, but it's also filthy and can move a lot. And it's so electric. And I think it was him being able to have confidence in himself to throw it over the plate and attack the strike zone and seeing, oh, I'm getting a lot of swings and misses here. Let me go with the changeup. Well, that's disgusting too. Let me go with the And I think it was the confidence, and I think it radiated for him off the field too. He was just having a good time because he was doing so well. So I think that was the biggest thing that I saw in the changes from last year to this year, was just the confidence in his stuff and realizing that, yeah, he was a really good pitcher. And yeah, he was just always nice, always said hello in the clubhouse. And yeah, another, you know, like a cool Cotton that we missed to have around.
It's always good to hear that when somebody with that much talent is also just like a decent human being.
Yes, it definitely helps.
You got any more questions, Hogdale?
I mean, really just a general like observation, like, man, such a great time to be a minor league broadcaster, especially in the Red Sox system, where this farm team over this year, last year or two, is just loaded with insanely good talent. I mean, it must just be a joy to broadcast. I can imagine.
Oh yeah. I mean, and it really started last year with having Tristan Casas up here but then also seeing the surprise guys like Ryan Fitzgerald have such success and stuff. So it's so cool to see, you know, you got the top prospects and then you've got the guys that don't have that top prospect label. And then all of a sudden they make a name for themselves and they put themselves into those conversations, because Brandon Walter wasn't a top prospect. And, you know, he was kind of that lower guy who was like, oh, okay, well, he's gotten better. And then all of a sudden, you know, he's bust onto the scene and, you know, has that mentality that, you know, he's still in his mind isn't a top prospect. And that's how he's approaching everything still, is like, oh no, I still have a lot to prove because I was a late round pick. So it's such a fun combination of those guys, the high draft picks and the, you know, the guys that everybody knows their names. And then the guys were like, hey, you don't know me, but you should.
Love that mindset.
No, that's got to be. Is there okay? So one more question, actually. Is there one player that we should know that we probably don't yet?
I would say Steven Scott, but he is one of those fringe top prospect guys. But the way he gets on base, like he was intentionally walked last night in the 10th inning. He just gets on base. I mean, his on base percentage at one point was close to 500 because he's so patient. And the amount of times I have seen him work from an 0-2 count to a full count to draw a walk, it's insane. So, you know, I know he's one of those fringe guys, but I mean, he can also hit the ball really well. Had quite a few home runs for us since his promotion. He joined us on the road down in Richmond, and has been really solid for us ever since. He's a good catcher. He caught some of the rehabs for us in Hartford whenever we had a couple different major league guys join us there too. So I would say Steven Scott.
Do you know Steven Scott's nickname?
No.
When he was with, I forget if it was Greenville or Salem last year. No, I think it was Salem. He and Big Joe Davis lived together in like a trailer, and they had a bunk bed that they shared, and you know, like made beef jerky together, and they would refer to themselves as the Meatball Brothers.
Oh my God.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's my favorite thing about Steven Scott. And I genuinely hope that Big Joe joins him in Portland pretty soon, just because it's one of those dynamic duos that you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah. We got to reunite those two. That's great.
Anyway, again, this has been really fun. Emma Tietman is the play-by-play and media director. What was the exact position again?
Director of broadcasting.
So the director of broadcasting for the Portland Sea Dogs. And where can people find you?
Twitter is fine. Just Emma Teeds, EMMATIEDS.
And you can listen to her on any Portland broadcast. So again, thanks so much, and we will see you all next time.
Welcome to the Pesky Report, a podcast for Red Sox fans.
Thanks for watching. Make sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Pesky Report. Make sure to like, subscribe, and leave a review.
thank you for listening to this Belly Up Sports Podcast Network product. Some said we go belly up, so we made it our name, and we're still here.